Madison, first question. Madison said freedom of the press is the one right that guarantees all others. What would Madison think of our press today?
Well, it is another bit when people worry about American decline. As mentioned, I had written a biography of Walter Cronkite, and when he left the Evening News in 1981 as our kind of referee, the most trusted man in America, media press had about a 65 to 70% approval rating. And since that period of time when we would tune in just to three new nightly news broadcast and reporters were on a high, the public has gotten angry at media. And we're living in this age now with, because of the internet, people aren't sure what's facts and what's fake. How do we solve that? How do we create an honest debate if people are operating on different false premises with no referee? And one of the things that Cronkite had said to me, which I think we haven't done, is he said middle schools and high schools have to start doing a class. When he was young, he had to take typing. Cronkite said they need to take how to use the tool of the internet. That we're turning, you can clap for that. That is basically, they're saying we're turning over this whole world of information to kids that are 12, 13, 14 without any instruction manual. Just go at it. And you're wondering why there's a proliferation of hate sites and bad news sites and bots and, you know, all of this going on. We're not doing our job as of making sure our young people get educated on how to use that as a tool and not use it as something that abuses our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Annette?
Well, he had many feelings about the news. I think he would be aghast at the focus on private lives, that we're not, what is that about? And at the same time, I think he would be, upset at any notion that the government would try to tamp down on news sources. So this is just a world that is so different from what he could possibly have imagined. I mean, we have a press, but we also have a system with the internet now and social media where there are no gatekeepers. So everybody's the press in a way. I mean, I feel like if I'm posting on Facebook or Twitter, I feel like I'm a journalist in a way. If I'm commenting on things and speaking to people and, my followers respond back. So this is just a world that would have been unimaginable to him and actually probably quite frightening.
Has it changed the modern presidency? What's happening with social media, the use of Twitter, the way presidents communicate with the world?
Oh yeah, I mean has it
changed the presidency?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, President Trump knew how to use that medium. He was a genius at using that medium, and he understood that was a strength for him, that you could go directly to people and make his feelings known. I think lots of times presidents have wanted to sort of bypass, but then I guess it was Carter who did the speech with the cardigan or whatever, the melee speech, the infamous melee speech. But now the president can go on Twitter and he can say directly to people what he feels and do policy that way. And that was so shocking to people at first. But now, I think it's something that will probably stay. I guess the next president may or may not want to do that. But I guess President Obama had a Twitter feed as well. I don't think he tweeted as much as the current president, but he was very good at that. So it has changed things remarkably. There is no gatekeeper. There's no filter. The president can go directly to people.
Yeah, and obviously we judge presidents by how they are with communicating, and you'll find in history, Theodore Roosevelt would always have cartoonists around him and would use the cartoon as his form of media of that era. And then you have FDR who, radio wasn't invented by FDR. I mean, Herbert Hoover could have used it or Calvin Coolidge, but they didn't use the medium and FDR did with radio. And then I mentioned John F. Kennedy started holding White House press conferences and just doing this trapeze act or just throwing questions and answering it on live TV. And then Reagan learned how to perfect State of the Unions and these like major speeches. And Barack Obama was the big deal, the BlackBerry president. Mm-hmm. He had a BlackBerry. Trump took Twitter and ran with it. And we still haven't caught up with it because social media is a big phenomenon. And Donald Trump sees the world as how many followers do I have? And he judges power. He's interested in celebrities that have a lot of followers. If you're a congressperson or a state representative and don't have Twitter followers, Trump thinks you're a loser. Mm-hmm. And you know, but how long's Twitter gonna be the big deal? There's gonna be something new coming up, and it might be we have to find ways to restrain some social media. I mean, Facebook has taken off people that are Holocaust deniers, gone. You know, it's freedom of speech has its limits. You can't go into theaters and scream fire when there isn't one, and the internet has not been patrolled properly, and we're gonna have to figure out in this cyber age how to make sure that we're not being overly abused with hateful anger, language, without also losing our great gift of freedom of speech. It's tricky.
Hyper-partisanship has occurred and reoccurred over our history. Is this time different? And if so, how is it different? What causes these periods of hyper-partisanship?
I would just say that I don't recall Thomas Jefferson, as bad as it was in 1800s, screaming, lock him up. that was a pretty brutal election we just went through. We've had others that have been brutal, but the amount of name calling it this late in the 21st century, a kind of a degrading democratic experience in many ways. I think we've got to kind of not applaud people that just say outrageous things. We're in a culture now where the most outlandish thing you say gets coverage, where the sensible people that are trying to do compromise and make government work are considered dull and boring, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. We're favoring sensationalism over understanding of how our government's supposed to work, our civic necessities we need to function as a democracy.
Well, I think in periods of scarcity, there's a heightened sense of partisanship among citizens. In the 50s and the 60s, when America was doing very, very well, people could be magnanimous. You have the civil rights movement, there were people who were opposed to that, but you feel freer to move, I think. But when people feel that they're losing something, whether it's an economic position or status or whatever, that brings out a lot of extremism, that people feel that they're trying to protect themselves in some sort of way. And I think when the question was, why does it recur? There tend to be moments when people are anxious, they're at ease, uneasy about something, whether it's their economic status, their social status, or whatever. A feeling of loss, the possibility of losing things, you want to band together with your team to make sure that you win. And I don't really, sort of interesting, the founders dislike the idea of faction, but it's sort of hard to imagine how they could think that you would not at some point come to have a different sense of what the public interest was. Alexander Hamilton and Jefferson had very different understandings. They were both revolutionaries, but they had very different understandings about what that revolution was about, what it was supposed to achieve. And the 1790s were brutal because of that, as they were trying to work that out. What was the revolution for? What it should be the direction of the country? And again, once you get rid of a king, that one force, the person who's and king and parliament for Britain when they got to that point. And it's the people, they're gonna hash these things out, and you're gonna have these moments of extremism going from one position to another.
Have we ever in history had this kind of extremely partisan behavior by both parties? I mean, this is really as partisan as I've ever seen it in my lifetime. Have we seen that before?
Not in our lifetime, but obviously in American history, it's been a lot worse. I mean, you know, in the 1850s, for example, people would in Congress wouldn't just insult each other, they could cane each other, beat them. And I mean, and then, of course, the Civil War speaks for itself when you have our country torn apart and 600,000 plus dead. And, you know, so there are a lot of times when the politics, I think, are worse than right now. In the 60s, it was rough, hawk and dove, and the establishment versus the counterculture. Mm-hmm. But what's a little bit odd right now to me is that, when Barack Obama was the president, a lot of Republicans didn't want to be in a photo showing that they did any accomplishment with Obama because it wouldn't play back in their district. Mm-hmm. You know, and Democrats certainly now don't want to be seen running with it, being around Donald Trump. So it's become that partisan country that people are saying the president represents only my faction, not both factions. And it used to be presidents would at least try to do an olive branch. I mean, we're here in beautiful Monterey Coast, and we talk about California in the 60s environmental movement, and it's stunning to think that Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. Nixon created endangered species and clean air and water because he was listening to a Congress that was, you know, instead of just saying they're all out to lunch, there was still a feeling of compromise. Part of it is modern transportation. Congress people and government want to leave and flee. It used to be without easy modern transport, people would stay in D.C., have cocktail parties, talk and negotiate a little bit more. So this partisan divide right now, I think, is the worst in the audience's lifetime, not anywhere near comparable to something of that Civil War era.
Mm-hmm. Annette, were the Federalists and the Republicans, highly partisan?
Oh, well, yeah, they were very nasty. I mean, they didn't say lock him up, but they said that Jefferson was dead. The Federalists sent out a rumor that said that he died. And so there's no point in...
Oh, fake news.
Fake news. Oh, fake news has been here forever. I mean, you know, Benjamin Franklin made up these massacres and had them printed in the newspapers, massacres by Native Americans that never happened, sent them out. So, yeah, no, the Federalists and the Republicans were very, very nasty to one another. I mentioned before that at some point there was a thought that because Jefferson and Jefferson and Burr tied, and there was some sense if Jefferson wasn't seated, there would be a civil war. People were talking about raising armies and stuff if the intent of the people was not actually carried out. Mm. So there have been other partisan times. You mentioned the 1850s, Charles Sumner getting caned and so forth. But you're right, it's interesting now that we've come to a point where people don't, after a period where people did do some things together, don't even want to be seen in the same frame. A lot of it has to do with money in politics. I mean, the way people and districts that are drawn for individual people and that they're going to be incumbents
safe
to go
district.
Forward,
yeah.
safe
yeah.
districts that they're going to go on. If they really had to face a public whom they had to convince. This thing I said about persuasion, that changes you when you know you have to make the case to lots of different people.
Yeah.
And it moderates you and it makes you think about different ways of solving problems. And a lot of them don't have that, so they don't really need to appeal to people in the same way.
Yeah, and look, it used to be that people, ever since FDR, let's just do modern times, the belief that the federal government was here to be your friend and was gonna do something. It was controversial, but FDR could do Grand Coulee Dams and Tennessee Valley Authority and Social Security, and government is going to help the little people, the person struggling, federal government. And Truman creates National Security State with NSC and CIA and government, and then and the GI Bill and all of that. And then you get Eisenhower does the interstate highway system and the St. Lawrence Seaway, and John F. Kennedy, all of us, 50 years ago, we're going to put a man on the moon and bring him back alive. It was bipartisan. And Johnson's government with the Great Society, Medicaid, Medicare, and Jimmy Carter creates FEMA and Department of Energy, and then Reagan. And when Reagan gets elected, it's the beginnings. And Reagan was a highly rated president and a good one. But there starts creeping in that the federal government is the enemy, that the government is the problem, that they're overtaxing you, they're ripping you off, they lied to you in Vietnam, there's something wrong with Washington, D.C., and that politicians are no good. And yet you could say, well, what about Clinton and Obama? Well, Clinton did triangulation to get stuff done. And Obama had to become like a firewall to protect the heirlooms of the federal government. Don't touch Social Security, don't drill the Arctic, don't undo Medicaid and Medicare, and got the Affordable Care Act in. But there are too many Americans right now that think the enemy is the United States government, and that number is high. And how are we going to build our country when you have many citizens that think the enemy is within, and it's called, it's the whole, you know, everything since Woodrow Wilson and the Federal Reserve is the enemy. That leads to conspiracy theories and a kind of a neo-Civil War-like feeling in the country.
Well, the government is an enemy unless the government is doing something for me. And everybody has something that the government is doing for. It's just that when the government is doing something for that other person, the government is the is the enemy in a way. And so that's, it's an interesting idea when we are supposed to be the government. We are supposed to be the people who vote them in and keep them honest and, you know, vote them out when they don't do the things that we think are right. They're not some foreign, entity that has nothing to do with us. But that's, I think you're right, there's a different understanding about the government, particularly, as I said, when they're doing things for other people.
Yeah, I mean, an interesting point. I mean, I've never met a farmer who thought that the government was a friend. Farmers have always said, stay out of my life. On the other hand, with all the support price programs and with the program, the president just announced another $16 billion in aid for trade, the farmers are going to get the benefit of that. And yet it is government providing that payment. Mm-hmm. You're right. I think it depends on
who you are. I was out in
Idaho.
Who's
getting the benefit?
I was out in Idaho some years ago, and I was talking to a group of people, lovely people. But I mean, the story is that their forefathers came there on their own, effort, by themselves, carved out this space. And it's like, wait a minute, wasn't there an army that? There's irrigation, there are all these other kinds of things where they did things by themselves, but they had help as well, and it was a government as well, but people don't think of that as much.
What we had at the time of the Founding Fathers was something common, which was we fought for American independence against Great Britain, and we don't want a monarchy, and that's what they shared. What other factional differences there was, you had in the Cold War, we had the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. What is it that unites America today? Mm-hmm. From the Cold War gave us always a proxy for it, but now we're kind of left on our own and we're turning inward on each other.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the Russians.
Speaking of the Russians. We must always speak of the Russians.
Have foreign governments ever interfered in U.S. elections in the past?
People assume they did. People thought the not interfered.
Well, as a member of the CIA, I have to be careful. I think the reality is that governments have tried to interfere.
Of course,
throughout.
Look at Woodrow Wilson in World War I when we had to deal with the so-called Zimmerman telegram. Mm-hmm. From Germany trying to incite Mexico to attack us, so we would be forced to fight on the border instead of getting involved with the Arab War. There's always been diplomatic. Meddling, if mm-hmm. you like, or in foreign affairs, meddling in our democracy. But the cyber world, I keep getting back to it today, presents really new challenges. And cybersecurity should be the top of all of our list of concerns. What happened in 2016, what if Russia or China tries to undo our democracy in 2020? And I'm concerned about it more than I perhaps think people were, back with one telegram or one intercept or a spy or two here or there. It can be done now in a very direct way on election day.
Mm-hmm. And certainly fomenting dissension among citizens, as I mentioned before, you know, with thinking about the internet comments that you think are, you're talking to somebody, a neighbor, and you're talking to, it's a Russian bot or something that you're discussing things with. So it's very, we're in a very complicated time.
But this is certainly the first time we've had as bold an effort by an adversary to try to interfere directly in our election process.
Yes.
I think everyone acknowledges what they tried to do in 2016 and 2018 and possibly in 2020 as well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that relates to social media and the ability to impact through that source. If checks and balances in our Constitution are no longer working as they should, what will, how do we, the people, keep government power in check?
Sue. No, just kidding, just kidding. You know, but I mean, I'm only, you know, like if, for example, if you see the Obama Interior Department doing an overreach on some land in the West, there are lawsuits that go, and that slows things down to people can see whether it's overreach. Suing has become an American tradition, for better or for worse. And you know, the legal law has to prevail. We cannot act like anybody is above the law. The president has certain rights, but the idea that a president can never be indicted is to me a frightening proposition that we haven't had to really contemplate. We've had Warren Harding problems and Andrew Johnson problems, but the Donald Trump problem is quite large because of his trying to be he has a dictatorial bent that needs checked a lot, and it's the courts that are going to have to do the checking in the immediate realm.
I think contacting your congressman, being involved in politics, voting, making your feelings known about these kinds of things. Would matter to you if constituents contacted you. People can't take things for granted. I think there's such a complicated world and we're all busy and we have so much to do and the thing seems to be running without us, but it's really not. It is not running well without us. And so I think the only thing you can do is participate, is to be vigilant and really look at things and make your feelings known. But not just by voting. Voting's important, but coming out to meetings, meeting congressmen, writing to them, doing that kind of thing, letting people know that they're out there. If they become too complacent about all of this, and the system just drifts away.
This is an interesting one that raises the issue of states' rights. But how would the founders interpret states' rights and personal property on the issue of abortion bans in Alabama and Missouri?
Go ahead.
You want to check?
How would the founders, the founders, during the founders' period of time, states' rights, during the founders' period of time, abortion was not illegal before quickening. So this was not something that would have been considered to be a private matter. Now, all the founders, the different founders would have had obviously different responses to that. They all had different, you know, viewpoints about matters, obviously. Not just, and abortion would not have been something that they would have been thinking of. I assume they would have assumed that if this were something criminalized, that would be a state right. States deal with criminal law.
Yeah, and we're dealing with gender and evolution and ideas of gender. I mean, the 2020 will be the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. So we're talking about founders and their wisdom, but women were excluded from everything. And even in 1920, women were the culmination of all that suffragist fighting, and still it was really white women that were getting the right to vote in 1920. It took the Civil Rights Acts of the 60s to push it forward. So I don't know if the founders had a conception of woman power.
Yeah,
that we have
didn't.
Today. But look at how many women have just become part of the class of 2018 in Congress, and women are getting into politics more and more, and that may be where the future is, because women may be able to compromise more than this kind of ugly thing that's been going on the last decade. More women in politics will be a good thing.
Let me ask you on the power of impeachment, which is provided in the Constitution, which is provided to the Congress to be able to move against a president who violates the law. The reality is that no president has been impeached, in terms of
convicted.
Of having a Senate conviction and removed from office. We've come close. Nixon is probably as close as we've ever come. But generally, it's a political process. So obviously, parties are going to play a role in determining what happens with impeachment. At the same time, the Justice Department has said that a president cannot be indicted for violating the law during the time that that person is president. What would our forefathers say to a situation where if you can't impeach the president because of the politics of the Congress and you can't indict the president, then what would our forefathers say should be the recourse to deal with a president who violates the law?
You went.
Where the hell do you go?
Well, that would be checkmate. The Justice Department, that's a Justice Department policy. That's their opinion. It's not entirely clear to me that the founders would have agreed with that opinion because it would be checkmate. If you're saying you can't. Well, obviously they ought to be able to impeach. That's a political question. That's right. Because they don't want to. It's not that they don't have the power. The DOJ rule is something separate. The impeachment power is clear. The DOJ rule is something they made up. So I think the founders probably would just unmake that up.
Yeah. Well, just with the question is, did President Trump obstruct justice? And people are arguing with that. This is the fight within the Democratic Party right now, whether to impeach Donald Trump. There's a group of Democrats that are saying what Mr. Panetta is. This is tough. No president gets ripped out of office. They have all this presidential power. You can try to stain them with the eye in history that Congress right now in this climate very well would move to impeach Donald Trump, but the Senate would say no, and Trump could come out as, I told you, they're just the obstructionist Democrats and use it for political leverage. But on the other hand, there's another group of Democrats who are saying we must impeach Donald Trump. Now, if we really do believe it was obstruction of justice and our subpoenas aren't being answered, and what are we telling young people if we don't go forward in our exercising of our belief that a president had abused power? So it is a tough question, and particularly when you have electoral politics ramming up right against it in 2020. Do you operate with your head, your heart? And how much should political concern sway?
I would say about the DOJ policy, I should just say, doesn't just apply to the current president. The interesting nature of that applies just in general, this idea that any president, what they do could not be indicted. I just find that a fascinating one, and that's whether the current president or anybody, where does that policy come from, and what is the purpose of it?
Let me, as we get close to wrapping up here, as historians, and with 250 years of hindsight, if you could go back to the framing of the Constitution, what, if any, changes would you make?
You're asking me that? Well, first I gotta say, there's no slavery, all right? Okay, but seriously. No, that was a serious answer. I would have a parliamentary system. Doug.
Yeah, I think that the problem with it was the kind of litmus test to who was a real American right out of the gates was a problem, that you had to be a white person and of a certain kind of economic bearing to become a member of the Continental Congress and then to be a founder of our country, and it excluded so many people, not just African Americans with slavery, but the treatment, the horrific treatment of Native Americans of that era, and that they were seen as not human and subhuman, and this is always embarrassing when you want to celebrate.
Would you do anything about the Electoral College?
We were talking a little bit about this earlier, and it is frustrating for people to realize that every vote doesn't count, in the sense that if Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by 3 million votes, she's not president due to the Electoral College. But I think the Electoral College is here to stay. I don't think it's going to be done away with, and I know that disappoints a lot of young people. But we have a hard enough time with right now. Like if you look at 2000 with Florida and dangling chads and Bush and yeah. Gore and recounts in Florida. Imagine a close election where every county, every state has to be recounted. It could wreak havoc. Let alone the proposition that if you do away with the Electoral College, that politicians will only play for big urban areas.
And that, what would you say?
If we go back to the beginning, I would say I would not have it. But I think he's right. At this particular moment, it would be hard. Small states are not going to vote to get rid of their power. They're not going to do that.
We've come to the end of this session. Again, I want to turn to the audience and tell you that in talking about the Constitution, it begins with the words, "We the People." And I think the one thing I've learned from this session, and frankly from the other sessions we've had, is that ultimately it is we the people that will decide whether our democracy survives. And the only way we the people will do that is becoming active and interested and vote and participate in our democracy. That's what this lecture series is all about. Thank you for supporting us, and good night.